How can we envision the sweeping changes to entire landscapes?
Ownership of commons, the air, soils, water, biological diversity, back to the
diversity is as critical as biological
disorientation. In this epic struggle to preserve a habitable
planet, that is the only thing which is sustainable.
The place that you love is now under siege.
Deregulated commerce is becoming a threat to the life on this planet.
These are system problems.
Our humanity is
We shouldn't ask whether we can survive.
These are existential
or
questions
not.
As much as they are systemic questions.
Put these
action informed by knowledge of
get down
place.
To work.
You're listening to the Schumacher Conversations, a series of lively discussions featuring some of the foremost voices in the movement for a new economics. The conversations engage prominent E.F. Schumacher speakers as they reflect on past lectures and their enduring relevance given current economic, social, and ecological realities.
Any public program to preserve land or produce food is hopeless if it does not tend to right the balance between numbers of people and acres of land, and to encourage long-term stable connections between families and small farms.
Let's have a look at it.
Hazel Henderson and Juliet Shore engaged in the following Schumacher conversation, moderated by David Bollier, on September 24th, 2020.
Welcome to the Schumacher Center's latest set of conversations with leading thinkers and activists. We like to see these events as beacons of hope and guidance in these troubled times, and so we're really appreciative that you were able to join us today. I'm David Bollier, the director of the Schumacher Center's Reinventing the Commons program. My life revolves around studying how the commons is emerging as a new paradigm of economics, governance, and culture, and how commoning can bring about solutions that are elusive or impossible in our current political economy and culture. In light of my own work, I'm thrilled that we have some quality time today with two pioneering and dissenting economic thinkers, Hazel Henderson and Juliet Shore. Both have not only moved beyond the stale artificial concepts and parochial categories of conventional economics, they've probed the richness of real life with great empirical energy to reveal just how narrow and parochial the economics discipline and the politics that flows from it have become. I'd like to introduce each of them and then let each reflect on how things have changed since they gave their own Schumacher lecture many years ago. First, let me start with Hazel Henderson. For the past 50 years, Hazel Henderson has been a path-breaking advocate for ethical markets, socially responsible investing, green economics, and values that can't be quantified in money. Hazel is the founder of Ethical Markets Media and a world-renowned futurist, evolutionary economist, and syndicated columnist. She is also a prolific author, lecturer, television producer, and economic iconoclast. Her book titles give you a good idea of some of her passions: Building a Win-Win World, Beyond Globalization, Planetary Citizenship, and Ethical Markets, Growing the Green Economy, among many other books. Hazel's been an academic at UC Santa Barbara and UC Berkeley, a board member of such publications as Future Research's Quarterly and the State of the Future Report, and an advisor to the U.S. Office of Technology Assessment and the National Science Foundation. In all of this, she brings a deep interdisciplinary knowledge of economics and political theory to contemporary environmental and social concerns. Hazel has also had a very special relationship with the Schumacher Center. She helped arrange E.F. Schumacher's first lecture tour in the U.S. in 1974, working with Robert Swan, who later founded the Schumacher Center, and Ian Baldwin, who later founded Chelsea Green Publishers. Her essays were much admired by Schumacher for bringing, quote, more reality than almost any other writings on societal problems I know, end quote. Hazel gave the 9th annual Schumacher lecture in 1989 on development beyond economism. The theme of that year's lectures were the path to decentralism since E.F. Schumacher. We should have a great conversation today because our other guest, Juliet Shore, is another original thinker about the values that lie beyond the marketplace. Julia is an economist and a sociologist who teaches at Boston College, where she studies trends in working time and leisure, consumerism, the relationship between work and family, women's issues, and economic justice. Juliet's titles, the books that Juliet has written, also show the passions that animate her life. The Overworked American, subtitled The Unexpected Decline of Leisure. The Overspent American, Why We Want What We Don't Need. Born to Buy, The Commercialized Child and the New Consumer Culture. And Plenitude, The New Economics of True Wealth. Among other, I'll mention her latest book in a moment. But Juliet is not just a scholar and analyst, she's really a doer. She co-chairs the board of the Better Future Project, which is an activist project based in Massachusetts that deals with many of the issues mentioned here, as well as climate change. Juliet has co-founded such important projects as the Center for a New American Dream, South End Press, and the Center for Popular Economics. For the past 10 years, Juliet has been studying the so-called sharing economy in its fullest dimensions, ranging from the nonprofit community initiatives such as makerspaces and time banking, and the Silicon Valley platforms like Airbnb, TaskRabbit, and Uber. Just a month ago, she published a new book, After the Gig, How the Sharing Economy Got Hijacked and How to Win It Back. The book offers strategies for how citizens can take back online platforms, especially through such vehicles as platform cooperatives, so that they can have tools for better ways of working and for developing a regenerative economy. Juliet gave the 31st annual Schumacher Lecture in 2011 as part of a program that featured young people involved with Occupy Wall Street, which was occurring at the time. Her talk, The New Economics of Plenitude, probed the perversities of conventional economics and the pathologies that result, such as inequality, waste, anti-democratic politics, and much else. A few notes before we get started. Hazel and Juliet will give us 7 to 10 minutes of reflection on their past lectures and how they might update their talks for the current moment. And after each has spoken, we'll move on to some questions, some posed by me and many more of them posed by you, the audience. You can ask your questions through the Q&A box at the bottom of your Zoom page. And I have to apologize in advance that all of your questions won't be able to be posed simply because we have several hundred people on this Zoom connection. I will add that the chat box is disabled, so you'll have to use the Q&A box. You should also know that we're recording this conversation so it will be available tomorrow for viewing on the Schumacher Center's website. And let me also take a final opportunity to note that if you're so moved, you can support the cost of these free events by Schumacher Lectures by donating to the Schumacher Center via its website and its homepage. So thank you for joining us, and let's begin with Hazel.
So, of course, I am extremely fortunate in as much as E.F. Schumacher was a good friend. And as David said, I helped organize his first lecture tour in the U.S. And he stayed with me at our home in Princeton many times. And we used to have the local faculty people from Princeton University would come over and sit at his feet. And he and I were on many platforms together, and he used to love to quote me with my one-liner, economics is a form of brain damage. And really, most of my early work and what I presented at the first Schumacher lecture was very much about what I was calling the non-money, unpaid, I called it the love economy, which is the 50% of all economic activity, useful production of goods and services, unpaid. And it wasn't until 1995 that I helped to persuade the Human Development Index at the UN to have a go at estimating the value of that unpaid work. And they came up with a total of 16 trillion with a T. And they said 11 trillion of that work was performed by women and 5 trillion performed by men. And the if it had been not just missing from the annual GDP numbers that year, which was 24 trillion, it would have added that 16 trillion and it would have been 40 trillion would have been the annual GDP number that year. And so that whole approach of looking at the non-money half really energized me into critiquing the economic textbooks. And I tried to get inside the head of these economists, and I was reading those textbooks, and their view of human nature was really that humans were always selfish, individualistic, always out to compete with each other, and all of that stuff. And that volunteering was irrational. And of course, women's work, raising children, managing households, serving as volunteers on the school board and all of those things, was uneconomic and therefore not included, of course, because they're all about money. And if money doesn't change hands, the economists don't think anything is happening. And so the GDP is simply a cash flow kind of model. So I began to really dig into what was the goal in these economists' minds. And Kenneth Arrow and Gerard Debreu made it pretty obvious in the early 1950s. I think Arrow ended up getting a Bank of Sweden prize, I think, in something like 1953 for this work. And what they aimed for as kind of the social goal of all societies would be what they called market completion. And I was absolutely horrified because that meant that every transaction in my beloved non-money love economy should be turned into a cash transaction. And they even had studies that said that marriage was simply an economic transaction between men and women, sort of some kind of, you know, legalized prostitution or something. I mean, it was so horrible. I couldn't understand it. And so I've had this lifelong effort, and I've often been called an anti-economist for that reason, because somehow I wanted to dethrone this discipline, which had pretensions to be a science, which of course obviously isn't. And even to the extent of having the Bank of Sweden lobby onto the Nobel Committee, this phony prize called the Bank of Sweden Prize in Memory of Alfred Nobel. But I got together with Peter Nobel, the descendant of Alfred Nobel, and he and his family were really saying that that this was proper intellectual property theft, and that Alfred Nobel had never recognized economics as a science. And that's why there was no economics prize. So all of these themes, fast forward to today, I'm still kind of working on that underlying reality of what David calls the commons and I call the commons. And that is this enormous shared common resource, both in the natural world and in the human activities, that never should be within the money calculations. And so the most recent report, you know, at Ethical Markets Media, we have been publishing every year a thing we call the Green Transition Scoreboard. And we started in 2009 when the UN Climate Group got together in Copenhagen, and everybody sort of knew it would be a train wreck because it was all about naming and blaming and shaming, you know, between the polluting industrial countries, tier one, and the countries in the developing, mostly in the developing South, who were on the receiving end of all the pollution which they hadn't created. And so the debate was incredibly sour there in Copenhagen, and we released our first green transition scoreboard, and we said, okay, while all of you are arguing about these very real issues, we just wanted to remind everybody that in the private sector, private investors like me, frankly, and many, many others, had already invested $1.3 trillion in solar, wind, energy efficiency, all of the transition companies and technologies, which I referred to in a book I wrote in 1981 called The Politics of the Solar Age. And it's right there behind me, you see, in behind my shoulder there. And it's now in 800 libraries in 27 languages. But when I published it, even though it got a rave review in the New York Times, that was kind of, it was 1981. And Reagan had just announced that it was morning in America. And we could go back to the way things were in the 50s. He took the solar panels off the roof that Jimmy Carter had put on there. And I went on my travels around the world with speaking engagements around that book, talking about the politics of the solar age, because I had spent 6 years in Washington seeing it up close and real and seeing all the lobbying power of the fossil fuel industry and the proponents of nuclear energy and how they grabbed all of these subsidies and tax breaks and everything else. And I never forget that the first meeting we had at the Advisory Council of the U.S. Office of Technology Assessment, which was founded in 1975. And I remember being at the first Advisory Council meeting. Of course, I was the only woman. And there were the presidents of Dow Chemical and Texas Instruments, and all of the others were really assorted Nobel Prize winners. And so naturally, they looked at me and said, go get the coffee. Because after all, I was a female, and therefore, you know, any female was there was obviously a servant. You know, that's just the way things were, you know, back in 1975, you know. And So basically, the U.S. Office of Technology Assessment was an attempt to separate out these economic drivers, all based on, you know, cash transactions, from all of the social sector and the government sector and the kind of investments that we needed to make. And one of the themes of my life had basically been the whole idea, you know, of how do we get all of these asset managers who are controlling all of our pension funds and our 401ks, how could we get them to understand that they were reading out of these obsolete economic textbooks? And all of these crazy ideas had gotten deeply buried into the algorithms by which they were running their portfolios, gigantic portfolio, like it's about $60 trillion now of pension fund money. And so one of our latest our Green Transition Scoreboard reports, which we've been cumulatively adding up all of these private green investments, our latest total is $10.3 trillion. And basically, we were trying to say to them, look, you know, what you're looking at in your algorithms is actually what we would refer to as magical thinking. It's all inside your heads. And meanwhile, the real world, you can do what we call science-based investing. And you can look out there and see all of these new technologies and the way we can take all of the stranded assets in the fossil sectors and shift them now to all of these wonderful opportunities. And right, I mean, I feel my job is almost done, because I did a video lecture with a group of investors in London in mid-2020 called Beyond Oil, a week-long seminar they were having, all to investors. And it was called Beyond Oil, The Birth of Big Green.
That's a great moment for us to pause for a moment, Hazel, and get Juliet into this conversation. That's a wonderful story. Juliet, maybe you could pick up the thread from where when you gave your lecture in 2011 and some of the developments you've seen happen over the past 10 years.
Yes, well, thank you, David and Hazel. It's a great privilege to be here with both of you. I admire both of your work so much. And you both sort of put me in mind of something that I, just a little bit of something to start with. The first Hazel story about being asked to get the coffee, and it made me think, I suppose it's not an accident that the two of us here today are women. And David reminded me about Occupy and my lecture. I didn't have the honor of being one of the early Schumacher lecturers, but I gave my lecture during Occupy in the early days. And in fact, before I went uptown to deliver the lecture in New York, I was down at Zuccotti Park and in a nearby building, but doing a session for occupiers. And what was really striking to me at that time, and this was true in the other Occupies that I went to as well, was how extraordinarily hungry folks were for alternative economics, for a non-mainstream economics that, you know, speaking to Hazel's point about being brain dead and how much it had disappeared from the colleges and universities since the time I had been studying, when, you know, there was a lot of it a lot of it being taught and so forth, you know, much of it by my own teachers. And so that was a great, really good to remember that. I had forgotten that I'd been down there before I gave my lecture. So my Schumacher lecture was about a book that David mentioned in my introduction. It was called Plenitude, The New Economics of True Wealth. It was a book I wrote in 2008 and 2009. So as the financial crisis was occurring and the recession, you know, an extraordinarily deep so-called Great Recession, to kind of tie it to the Great Depression, was unfolding. And there are some real similarities to today. One of them, of course, was widespread economic pain and recession, depression. The second, that was a big theme of that book, was the climate crisis and our failure to address the climate crisis in a serious way. And I also wrote that book at a time when I and others were despairing of the government actually doing much about climate in particular, but also enough about the dysfunctions of the global economic system, extreme inequality and 99.1% income and wealth concentration and so forth, which was all, you know, quite evident 10 years ago. So as we think about where we're at today, in many ways, those same themes are quite relevant. We are again in a major downturn. We again are failing to address climate change. And although we don't have robust government action on either of these, one thing that's different today is that we can see it on the horizon. It has become a possibility. And in fact, a very exciting, even intoxicating possibility. And yet at the same time, I mean, I just can't, you know, give a talk today, particularly because of the things that have been happening in the last week or so, without noting the extraordinary uncertainty of the current moment, the ways in which it is absolutely terrifying and exhilarating at the same time. I think we are facing the greatest peril to our democracy that we have faced certainly in my lifetime. The levels of corruption and sort of hollowing out of democratic institutions have reached, you know, an absolute crisis point. I mean, this is something that has been building for a long time. It was a sort of empty, a hollowed out structure, which is what has made it so easy for Trump to come in and destroy so much. And yet, at the same time, it is, we also have the greatest opportunity in my lifetime to actually enact deeply systemic progressive policy across a range of issues, not just healthcare, minimum wage, the Green New Deal, of course, which is, a really transformative economic, social, and climatic program. So, Just to be a little bit specific about that Plenitude book and what I wrote then and where we are today. So the Plenitude model was one which was about sort of delinking from the corporate economy. About it was directed to households and communities because I and others were despairing of sort of major action by the state, either states or the federal government. And it had a number of, four major dimensions to it, but I'll just mention that people working fewer hours, doing more self-provisioning, getting involved in more community alternatives that are democratic, and basically a commons, a commoning movement strategy. And one of the reasons that I got into the gig economy, studying the gig economy, which is what I've done in the decades since that I published that book, is that a number of community sharing initiative and sort of alternative economy initiatives, including what came to be known as in the United States, you know, taken from Latin America, the solidarity economy, cooperatives, land trusts, other kinds of trusts, all of those alternative democratized economic institutions, many of them were being formed at that time. And so I was interested in studying them to see, you know, what kind of possibilities they have for really beginning to transform our economy. And I think as David mentioned, I started out studying the nonprofits, but as the Uber and Airbnb and Lyft and the for-profit platforms began to scale, I expanded that research to include them. And a couple of things haven't gone the way we anticipated. I would say the first is that people aren't working fewer hours unless they are doing so involuntarily. So the idea of that shift toward a shorter hours economy, which I've spent a lot of time thinking about in the context of climate change, and which I think will be essential for wealthy countries to do, to have a reasonable approach to climate change that has some global equity built into it, that hasn't been happening. And these community alternatives, while they are growing, have not scaled at anything like the rate that the for-profits have scaled. And then, of course, the for-profits have were begun with some idealistic ambitions coming from the companies, mostly not Uber, but most of the others, but also many of the users who we, on both sides of the market, who we studied in those early years. In the subtitle of my book is How the Sharing Economy Got Hijacked and How to Win It Back. And the, import of the How to Win It Back is both, conventional kind of regulation, which I talk about in the book, but also shifting to a platform cooperative kind of model in which workers and users own and govern these platforms. Mm-hmm. So I think I'll stop there. We've got a lot out on the table.
Thank you so much, Julia, for just laying the table that you're sitting at. I mean, the question that occurs that I'd love to ask both of you is what you see as the strategic avenues for change right now. Who do you think are the most committed and strategically effective champions, or what strategies do you think could go the distance to open this up? Because you have quite a historical perspective, Hazel, over these years, And you've seen some things come to fruition, like that conference of oil executives you mentioned. On the other hand, we're thwarted in many ways from breaking through to systemic change. So how is systemic change going to come?
Yes. Well, I focused on changing the scorecard, the GDP. And from a very early stage, I persuaded Robert Kennedy, who was our senator in New York in the 1960s, to come on a helicopter ride with us. We'd show him all the point sources of pollution. And we told him that one of our projects at Citizens for Clean Air was to correct the GDP and to subtract the bads, that was the air pollution, from the good. And come up with a net kind of a figure. And he went on to make that magnificent speech at the University of Kansas in 1968 on all of the reasons why we should change GDP, which is kind of the start of all of this. And I was invited to be an advisor to the European Commission in 2007, and we put on a conference called Beyond GDP. And by that time, I had, with the Calvert Group that I was an advisor to for almost 20 years, we put together an alternative to GDP called the Calvert-Henderson Quality of Life Indicators, with 12 indicators of quality of life, very much like the SDGs. Only two of them actually were measured in money. The others were measured in the relevant scientific data that you would expect. And so I remember we put on a survey, a global survey in 12 countries, Ethical Markets and GlobeScan, the best social research group. And we asked two very simple questions. Which of these two statements do you most agree with? First statement, money denominated GDP is the best way to measure the progress of a country. Do you agree or disagree with that? And the second was GDP should be expanded to include scientific data on health, education, and environment. And we announced the results of this global survey, and over 80% in the 12 countries, North, South, East, and West, agreed with statement number two. You know, that of course the GDP should be expanded. And then we repeated that survey in 2009, right after the financial meltdown, to see if people had been driven back into fear, you know, because of no different. Everybody loved it, and then the same result. Then we did another one in 2013, same result. And we just have released the 2020 survey. And we still have 73% average of citizens in these global, in all around the world, who favor expanding GDP to include health, education, and environment. So the people in the world have always been way ahead of the economists and the politicians, you know, which, so I think we're finally getting traction on that. You know, a lot of people now are coming out, and basically we now have the alternative. And I like to sort of bumper sticker the what we should be doing. And that is, let's go beyond GDP, which really incentivizes bad behavior, like the seven deadly sins, count them, you know, greed and, you know, all those things. And let's move to the SDGs, which are the traditional values.
Sustainable development goals, for those who don't know that.
Yes, the sustainable development goals. And they really mirror what we were taught when we were kids, the golden rule. Do as you would be done by. And we taught that to our children. It's in every spiritual and religious tradition. So now we have the new scorecard, which is the SDGs. And I am thrilled that the UN has finally, you know, mastered the public relations part of it.
And although you may have seen that article in The Guardian recently that people that the meeting those goals is a different issue.
Yes, of course. But first you have to have the goals. And, you know, once you can steer those goals and once you can get it through every sector, and corporations now are having to stand up and salute, it's the outreach of the SDGs has been enormous. And so that's the way I like to thumbnail it now, from money and GDP and the seven deadly sins to the golden rule and the SDGs.
Great. Julia, what are your thoughts on some of the avenues forward?
Yeah, so I'm going to take a U.S. perspective here, sort of thinking about where we're at. And it's an interesting moment. I would say the following. Should we get a Democratic administration and a Democratic Senate, and we begin to implement some of this progressive economic policy that's being talked about in climate policy. To me, one of the key things about understanding where we're at is that for the most part, we're still in that New Deal mentality of a large government program to the Green New Deal. Of course, it's not an accident that it's called a Green New Deal. It has a kind of backward-looking dimension to it. And it's, I think much of this is necessary no matter what kind of direction we go in. So, for example, Medicare for All, I think, is, an obvious way to go and make sense, whether it's old or new, et cetera. But if we think about some of the more sort of far-reaching kind of structural and systemic change that many of us are working on, certainly the three folks here on the panel, but also in the audience and so forth, or to think about Schumacher's vision, which was, of course, small is beautiful, among many other things, but a much more decentralized, downscaled, Democrat, small D democratic kind of economy. So cooperatives and, similar kinds of commons arrangements. We're not there yet in terms of having built a really major political force ready to enact those kinds of changes. So we're still stuck in old-fashioned kind of social democratic policies. So then we ask the question, well, how do we go from those to what we're talking about, this more far-reaching downscaling, et cetera? And there, I think about a lot of the work that's being done largely in Europe, but a little bit in the United States too, which is to think about how radical kinds of alternatives go from being niche, existing in a niche, the way, many of the things that I've been involved in, David has been involved in, and Hazel too, I suppose, although she's more toward the centers of power, so I probably shouldn't include her in that. But those of us who are operating more on the margins, in some of these small scale, very alternative things, how do you scale those up to get them to a kind of system change level? And what the people who've been studying these transitions, they call them, these socio-technical transitions, especially when we're talking about energy system transitions or other ecosystem transition, water system transitions, and so forth, is you build your niche, you get proof of concept, to use a targeting word, and the next stage is really to start interfacing with policymakers and to begin to get support from the policy apparatus that comes back down and allows you to grow more rapidly. And I think that's the stage we're going to be at should there be a Biden administration. I've been talking to people about, for example, new things at the Small Business Administration so that it's not just supporting traditional small businesses, but a whole, a new sector there, which is really promoting cooperatives. And you can think about this at all, throughout all the divisions of the government, the ways in which once we have a you know, more or less progressive kind of administration, how the kinds of things that we've been working on over these last couple of decades, which now have real track records and we have evidence and we can show they work, we begin to get that policy support, which then allows us to really jump up to the next level so that the next time there's an opening for a big shift, we're ready.
If I can just follow up on the Green New Deal and very much agreeing with Juliet on this, I think that it's been evident that with this pandemic, you can have a paradigm shift, a major paradigm shift happen within weeks. And, you know, all of that University of Chicago stuff, you know, in all the textbooks that the oligarchs have pushed onto the agenda, you know, the law and economic stuff and, you know, deficits and the immorality of putting debt on our children, or, you know, all of that stuff. Suddenly, because there was this demonstration that the rate at which small businesses were going under with the lockdown and everything else, suddenly they turned 180 degrees. And instead of austerity and cuts and all of that, suddenly it's stimulus, stimulus, stimulus. And within a very short time, a $3 trillion bill comes out of the Congress. The Fed adds another $7 trillion of new money to the system. And suddenly everybody is realizing, in an economy that's driven 70% by consumerism, suddenly you have got to provide purchasing power for all of these people, or we will sink into a depression. And yet at the same time, the structure of our system right now, in as much as kind of, you could say the plumbing is broken, because they print all this new money, and it goes right back into asset bubbles and into banks and into foreign investments, you know, whatever. And everybody says, well, why, when they've printed all of this money, why isn't there any inflation? And I'm saying, come on, the plumbing's broken. It doesn't get down to the people who would spend it. The only way you keep an economy going like ours is to make sure that poor people get the money, because it's poor people that have to spend the money into the economy. And if you just throw it out there like spaghetti against the wall, the rich people take it and move it offshore into a tax haven. And so all of these structural problems now are evident to all of the NGOs that I deal with, who have now grasped the politics of money creation and credit allocation. So this is sweeping away a lot of the old ideology. And even the Fed chair, I mean, this was hilarious. He went on 60 Minutes, and there was a usual stupid question by the interviewer saying, well, where's the money coming from? And he said, well, we print it, of course. Central banks print it. That's what we're supposed to do. And he said, oh, it's not just printing the notes. He says, you know, it's done electronically. We move the decimal points. And, you know, and suddenly it's right there on national television. And so the groups I deal with, particularly in Europe, they have persuaded the Bank of England to admit that they print the money. And of course, it all ends up in asset bubbles. And they've got them to focus on the next time they do a quote unquote quantitative easing. It will be toward the green, the new future green economy. And this is the big question in the USA. Can we get the Green New Deal to focus on the future and building the green infrastructure? And I think that Stephanie Kelton has, with her new book, The Deficit Myth, has put it out there very clearly, you know, modern monetary theory. And it's now possible to say to people, look, if FDR during the Depression, if he had tried to pass the hat and get taxpayers to fund the Hoover Dam, wouldn't have happened that way. I mean, the Congress has the power of the purse, and you create the assurances, the guarantees through law, and then you let the contracts to build the Hoover Dam to the private sector. And that's the way it happens. And it's the way it will happen with the Green New Deal. And if we hadn't done it that way, and the Hoover Dam had never been built, which would never have been built by the private sector alone, Los Angeles would still be a village. Well, people are getting it.
Both of you are sort of going to the edge of a topic that I think we maybe should discuss more, which is how do we get out of the structural imperatives for growth so that we have to just shovel money into the economy to keep it going because it will collapse otherwise? How do we make a transition to a no-growth economy when we have, you know, the famous quote by Kenneth Boulding that anyone who believes exponential growth can go on forever in a finite world is either a madman or an economist. You know, how do we begin to build some different structures to get to fulfill the SDGs or the well-being economy and get out of the trap we're in?
Well, I have focused much of my work on local currencies. And all over the world, I have studied local currencies as a leading indicator of how bad the macroeconomic policy of that country was. And people are very sensible, and they look at the central bank and they say, well, if the croupier there at the central bank is not going to provide enough chips so that we can do our trades, okay, we just create our own chips. And not only all of the rise of the thousands of cities around the world who have local currencies, I've studied many of them in Brazil that grew up under President Lula and were actually sanctioned by the Bank of Brazil. They said, yeah, fine, if they want to clear their own market by creating their own currencies, that's great. It takes a little bit of heat off the real, you know. And then we have to recognize that there are more people on this planet employed in co-ops than all of the profit-making corporations on the whole world together. And so this is, you know, UN data. And so if you look at the reality, all of the alternatives, as Juliet said, are all there. We just have to look at them. And it's just bringing the micro together with policymaking and the macro.
Juliet, would you like to expand on that?
Yeah, well, there's a lot to say here. So the first thing I want to say, I think this is one of my little pet peeves that people don't understand about economic theory, which is there's nothing in conventional economic theory, mainstream economic theory, whether it's Chicago or Harvard or whoever, Arrow and DeBruyne, there's nothing in economic theory that says you need to grow. Economic theory is about sort of efficiency and competitive markets and so forth. Now, if you have a growing population, that's another story, but let's leave that aside for a minute. So this idea that somehow economics tells us we have to grow is really misunderstood. It's misunderstood, you know, a lot of economists have spent a lot of time telling us that the economy needs to grow, but there's nothing in their theory which says that. And so how did we get to where we got to? So that, you know, in the post-war era, we had that so-called growth imperative, and the politics came around growth as a way to deal with distributional conflicts, as a way to solve poverty and so forth. Mm-hmm. And that's a hangover. We're living in a hangover time from a period of time when growth actually was doing some good things. It was equality enhancing rather than inequality enhancing as it is now. And that era ended in about the 1970s, so for sure by 1980, in which you have immiserating growth and so forth. So that's the first point. So, okay, now people may be wondering, is that really true what I just said? Yes, because the models are all built on the choice of goods versus time that individuals offer to the market. If they want to buy more goods, they offer their labor power to the market. And so an economy in which people decide, no, I won't want to work more. I want to take productivity growth or the productivity I have today in the form of more leisure time. That is every bit as effective, optimal, satisfying, worthy an economy as one in which people want to work more. And the answer, this also gives us the answer to David's question, which was, how do we degrow? The only way to degrow, I think, is through shorter working hours. I just do not see another way for economies to basically get on paths of declining GDP and or constant GDP with declining material use. Remember, the Boulding quote is about materials use. It's not about the value of the economy. You can have in theory, you can have declining materials use with a rising value of GDP, because that's a monetary measure. That's a value measure. It's not a materials measure. So, and that's, of course, why the economists all think you can have infinite growth, because you can, quote unquote, decouple your materials use from your GDP.
Next point, Juliet, let me interject from an audience question.
Yeah.
They ask, the audience question is, will adaptation to climate change that involves using less fossil fuels and thus mechanization and automation make it harder to shorten work hours?
No, it makes it a lot easier because, well, yes and no. So what's going on with artificial intelligence makes it a lot easier because we can replace a lot of what humans are doing with machines. On the ecosystem side, and I actually typed an answer into the Q&A. Someone else asked about, well, what about all the labor-intensive things we have to do to restore the ecology and get out of the fossil fuel economy? Agriculture, et cetera. Green energy is more labor-intensive. Those things will require more labor power. But on balance, the amount of both unnecessary labor in the, you know, white collar labor, and also what, you know, some of my colleagues have called guard labor or supervisory labor, all those police we need that are, you know, putting down, enforcing an unjust system, for example, or all of the incredible waste that, you know, many of the GDP studies have shown that we just need so much GDP to solve the problems being caused by the dysfunctionality of the system. So there's a tremendous amount of labor already to be saved in the system, plus everything that's going to become obsolete as a result of AI. So I think there's a lot of scope for working hour reductions, even if I think it is right in agriculture and energy, we're going to have more labor intensive. But those sectors employ very few people at the moment. Things are different at the individual company level. There are imperatives in the system for growth. It has to do with the financial system. If we change that, there's less going to be less pressure on individual companies to grow. Remember, the story about degrowth is at the aggregate level, the total size of an economy. It's not about individual companies. And finally, I just a point on local currencies, because there's so much enthusiasm about local currencies, but local currencies, you know, as Hazel said, they solve problems when liquidity is not enough liquidity is the problem. In the United States, it's been the opposite of that. The system's awash in liquidity. It's the operation of the system. And I think that's one of the reasons that the local currencies haven't taken off here in ways that they have in other places where there's much more liquidity constraint. And of course, in the United States, you know, every central bank can print money, but only the United States can print money with a currency that is accepted around the world and won't necessarily crash because the bank. And finally, I'll just say one little thing about MMT. You know, it is not a new theory to say that when you have unused assets, when you're in a depression, recession, et cetera, deficits are good. You don't need modern monetary theory for that. You have Keynes, old-fashioned monetary theory. You know, that I think that the problem with modern monetary theory is when you're not in that situation, because a lot of what it argues doesn't make sense. But, you know, we probably don't want to go down that road.
Let me pick up a little bit here. The whole thing about GDP growth, the focus I've always used is basically that we always have to look at what's growing, what's dying, and what needs to be maintained. And, one of the key things that has to be changed structurally in terms of national accounts, I won't call it GDP, whatever it turns out to be, but GDP has never had an asset account. And so why is that important? Well, what it has meant is that all of the public taxpayer investments in very necessary infrastructure, as our cities were growing and needed roads and hospitals and schools and all of the infrastructure that allows you to have a modern society, all of that is registered on GDP as debt. And there is nothing on the asset side of the balance sheet to record how extraordinarily valuable all of those built assets are, which last for 100 years. And what we pointed out, we had a conference when President Lula took over in Brazil. I helped organize a conference in Curitiba called the first international conference on implementing indicators of sustainable development and quality of life. And we presented the Calvert Henderson quality of life indicators. We brought the people from Bhutan who have the gross national happiness and all of those people. And we pointed out this extraordinary problem, particularly for Brazil at the time, that they looked like they had a shockingly high debt to GDP ratio. Oh, Wall Street was terribly upset. Oh my gosh, you know, there's a Marxist has come in and oh, this is going to be terrible. And so luckily, Lula appointed a medical doctor to be the finance minister. And we gave him this information from our conference. I wrote it up. It's on my website. I called it Statisticians of the World Unite. And we gave the finance minister all of this information about how if you had taken all of those investments that the Brazilian government was making in schools, roads, hospitals, airports, everything that was needed, then and you would put it on the balance sheet as an asset, that you would have cut Brazil's debt to GDP ratio by up to 50%, just with a few keystrokes. So he went up to the International Monetary Fund and sat down with Ann Kruger and said, come on, you know, you can't do this to us. And so she relented and said, oh, well, okay, well, we'll do this in your case as a, quote, pilot project. And so they put out this new special national account for Brazil. And sure enough, of course, it cut Brazil's debt to GDP ratio by about 50%. And suddenly Wall Street fell in love with Brazilian bonds. Do you remember? Suddenly everybody wanted to buy Brazilian bonds. So see, this is how insane the system is.
That is an awesome story.
Arbitrariness to all of this that goes on. I want to pivot for a moment to Juliet and some of your gig economy explorations, because it strikes me that that's really a major part of the contemporary story, is how tech has become the neuroskeleton for us all. And we have a question from the audience about, you know, how is the COVID crisis different from 2008 through 2009 in terms of the sectors that has it hit, the service industries primarily, and how the growing power of tech platforms over our daily lives has grown because of the shutdowns. The question is, does this accelerate the imperative to democratize the platforms or blunt it? And I would add, how do you see we can start to re-democratize those platforms?
Yeah. It's a great question. So the 2008 crash was centered in finance and housing. And the current, so it was, a lot of, overbuilding in housing and lending to people who, were unable to pay at, when things slowed down. And of course, the financialization derivatives and so on and so forth. And a lot of bad loans that got packaged as good loans and so forth. A lot of fraud, et cetera. So this is not what's happened since March is not due to a financial crisis. It come about because of COVID, the lockdown, and that creates a massive transformation in the structure of consumer demand. So you have whole sectors that have collapsed because people are no longer able to or willing to, buy those things. So whether we're talking about travel, tourism's the biggest industry in the world. Of course, restaurants, et cetera, and then the growth of, certain other kinds of things. We've seen it very strongly in the gig sector, which I'm still studying. So the collapse of ride hail, the growth of food delivery, for example, and in-store shop, shoppers and so forth. Also, a big decline in things like apparel because people are at home. I love that story that Walmart reported lots of people buying tops and nobody buying bottoms because, as you can see, it's only our tops which are visible on Zoom. So what's happening in the tech world is, there's really a confluence of a number of things, only some of them connected to the lockdown. One is you've got tech workers getting organized on political issues, whether it's their unwillingness to be part of racist face detection systems or participation with ICE, and other, politically really objectionable and human rights objectionable activities. So the workers themselves are challenging the companies. You've got the political impacts of some of these companies, Facebook, YouTube, et cetera, in the ways that they are fomenting a tremendous right-wing extremism, pushing disinformation, the whole QAnon conspiracy, all of these things. So you've got a political challenge, and then you've got the sort of market or economic challenge, which is coming up through the democratic policy circles around monopoly power of a number of the tech platforms. And I think that, and then you've got some right-wing stuff going on too, because they think they're all, left havens of pushing left-wing ideology and so forth. So, the Trump government is also, coming down on some of them, some story in the paper today about Google and antitrust activity on Google. So you're in one of those overdetermined or perfect storm situations for the tech companies. So I do think they're going to be facing some major challenges, regulatory and political challenges. And I think, David, the last part of your question was about, what do we do? And I think the big takeaway, the big push that we need to make toward these tech companies is democratize the tech, because although a lot of people don't like tech, they're kind of anti-tech and et cetera. I think, and there's important insight and wisdom in that point of view. We don't want tech taking over all of our lives, but there's also tremendous opportunity in tech. When I think about the gig workers, the thing I love about the platform cooperative is that the technology obviates a lot of management functions. So it makes running a cooperative so much easier because workers don't have to elect a great big management to sit on top of them and get them to do things. There are algorithms now that do a large fraction of what management typically does in a company. So tech is, I think of it as like solidarity plus technology equals the kind of economy that we want to have. But it's all about, that solidarity then leading to the democratization of the tech, the ownership and the governments. And of course, David, you're the expert here on that. So I should probably defer to you.
Well, one question I have that I'm trying to answer is, can we get adequate finance to develop some of these tech platform tech platforms to scale so they can be serious competitors, because we've seen a number of failures, valiant, brave failures to try to do that. And I worry that a lot of the smaller scale things are not going to get venture capital money, but they do have great ideas and they do have solid communities that are creating value.
Yeah. Just can I pick up on this social media issue? I've written a lot about this the last couple of years, and we had a conference here with the World Academy of Art and Science on how democracy was challenged in the digital age. And the I do a lot of book reviews, and I've got about 10 book reviews on our site, including, I think, the two that really sum it up for me. And one is called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism by a Harvard professor, Shoshana Zuboff. And this is, monumental work. It's fabulous. And the other is by Rana Faruha, who is the business editor of the Financial Times. And it's basically on Google, called Don't Be Evil. And my approach is, obviously, they have to be broken up. And I can remember back in the days when I was at OTA, when AT&T got broken up. And everybody was, oh, my God, this is the end of the world, you know, AT&T being broken up. So what actually happened? We had 5 baby bells, many, many more jobs, lots more innovation, all kinds of new players came into the game. And so it's very clear to me, and this is coming from both sides of the aisle right now, we have to get rid of Section 230 in the Communications Act, which this was 1996, I believe, that absolved the technology platforms that were growing at that point, Facebook and Google and Twitter and all the rest of it, saying that they didn't have to take any responsibility as media platforms. They were just technology platforms, and they didn't have to have the same rules that the New York Times and we do and every other media organization does to curate your information and be liable for misinformation, hate speech, all the kind of rubbish and toxic content which is allowed on Google and Facebook and Twitter and all the rest of it. And so I think it will be very easy in it, hopefully when we get the new administration in to get rid of Section 230. So they, all of the media outlets have to observe the same journalistic ethics and rules in terms of truth. But also, I think that not only breaking these companies up, which will bring in, you see, right now, they can't get venture capital because everybody knows that they can't fight against the big monopolistic players. But once you've broken up the monopolistic players, you get a lot more innovation coming in. And at the same time, the cooperative community model is the way I think we should go. They should be really public utilities run by municipalities in the same way that they run the park service and collect the garbage and everything else, so that every community can have its own social media platform, no advertising. We have to get rid of the advertising model completely. And basically all of these local community platforms can link together. And there's absolutely no reason why they shouldn't be run as community operations, just the same way as many electric utilities are owned by municipalities. And so these public media access groups can just be layered on the public electric utilities. None of this is rocket science. And what we have to do really is to outlaw the algorithms which promote outrage. And that they, you know, there's a whole lot of really terrible academic programs teaching how you manipulate people's attention. It's taught, you know, by psychologists. And so these algorithms that should be outlawed because they are so manipulative. And so I think there's a lot of that thinking is coming out of Europe with the general data protection regime that they have now, where the user of these platforms owns the information, their own information, and can decide to pull it off a platform and move it. And also, there is a ruling that if you don't disclose how your algorithm is constructed and what are the assumptions underlying your algorithm, you get fined and you have to take your algorithm down. So focusing now on ethical algorithms is also extremely important, and the way they function in asset management as well.
Julia, do you have some thoughts on that?
I think Hazel said it pretty well. I mean, certainly the work coming out now on the algorithms and the biases of the algorithms is really powerful. And I mean, this is one of the things about democratic control of these companies. From the worker side, I've been my research is showing the ways in which the algorithms act unfairly to the workers on the gig platforms. And, mm-hmm. and with a worker co-op, you can avoid that kind of thing. There is that lack of accountability on the part of the algorithmic designers, I think. So that's something that it really just giving control of the to the platform employees wouldn't solve it, because they're in many ways the source of it, because not necessarily intentionally. This is something where we've got to set up. We're going to have really rigorous public accountability systems. So that include transparency of the algorithms. It also gets complicated when the algorithms get so complicated that people can't really understand what they're doing. We have to have, in my part of the gig economy, a big issue is the data, providing the data from the platforms to the regulatory agencies, but also to the public. And I think this is going to have to be a standard operating procedure in a world in which algorithms are doing so much. So we're going to have independent bodies that are testing the impacts of these algorithms, in the same way we have testing for the efficacy and safety of drugs and so forth. We're going to have publicly controlled, legitimate entities that with strong expertise that are able to figure out what these algorithms are doing and shut them down when they're contrary to law and the goals of a free society.
You think that federal regulators can do that, even though they don't have these mass, there's only three or four massive proprietary database companies that, I would imagine there's a practical problem of applying conventional regulation to something that is almost a monopolistic set of data.
Yeah. So yeah. What's interesting here, I think, is I've looked at this in the context that I'm studying, but it's pretty analogous more generally into some of the things that Hazel was discussing. We have all the conventional regulation that we've used, whether it's labor regulation or consumer regulation. And that's the pond in which the federal government has been playing or not playing, and the states too. I mean, the FTC, for example, it only went after Uber on one count, which was deceptive advertising. I mean, there's so many other illegal things that Uber has done, but that was the only place it actually has taken them to task. But we need a whole new set of law, which is around digital algorithms and digital activity, because it raises many new questions. So some of the big ones are around asymmetries of information, which you'll give undue power to one party or another in the exchange, for example. There are all these horror stories about things that Uber knowing when you're drunk And so it can raise the price because it knows you're willing to pay more, for example. You know, just they bought an app that allowed them to do that. They claim they don't use it, but who knows? You know, all of the digital discrimination that's going on, the fact that if you want to go to a neighborhood with fewer white people, you know, more black people in it, Uber charges you a higher rate, et cetera. So there's so many problematic outcomes that come about only because of the power of these algorithms. And we're going to have to develop a whole new set of regulatory instruments and laws that will force the companies to give that data to the government. I mean, not necessarily in ways that will make it impossible for them to use it in business. But, you know, these companies are doing that in cities around the world that have forced them to. So, for example, I talked to the person in Toronto who, which is one of the first cities that Uber finally agreed to give data to, and they use that data to regulate Uber. But Uber refuses to give it another in the United States. They're giving a little bit more now, but yes, when data is so much at the heart of what economic activity is, you can't allow it to just stay in private hands.
Mm-hmm. Let me move to a topic that seems to be hovering around a lot of these discussions, or at least a lot of public discussion, which is universal basic income. And especially if the economy is not going to be as growing as much, or people's personal income is not going to be so great, is universal basic income an approach? And I'm well aware that there are so many different variations. Which variations do you find attractive or especially repugnant?
Well, you know, I wrote my first article on guaranteed income with Robert Theobald, who kind of invented it. And in the 60s, we started a National Citizens Committee on guaranteed income. And we based our rationale on the fact that this leisure economy and automation was already automating vehicle production, you know, in Detroit, and the writing was on the wall. And we were involved in a thing called the Ad Hoc Committee on the Triple Revolution. And that was about the shift to the leisure society. And we laid it all out that you had to have minimum purchasing power for every individual in order to keep up aggregate demand and not sink the economy, because you had this cornucopia of goods and services were being produced, and you had to have consumers with money in their pockets to buy it, you know, or else the whole system would collapse. So we had it all worked out, you know, that there was going to be leisure and learning another language and learning to play the violin and setting up, you know, your own midget businesses. And so I've followed that, and all over the world, you know, there have been experiments where you find that people don't take the money and go out and get drunk. Actually, people are very responsible. All of the experiments that I know about, people have been extremely responsible. They have started new micro businesses and all kinds of good things. And it is really the logic of aggregate demand. If you're going to have an economy, a democratic economy run on consumer demand, in this day and age, at the level of technology we are, you have to have some minimum guaranteed income. So I'm all for it, and I've been for it for decades.
Any thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's funny because Hazel says she wrote her first paper in supporting this. I wrote my first paper when I was in graduate school arguing against it. And at that time, I was arguing for full employment, but with shorter hours. And, you know, government basically guaranteeing, you know, that we would have full employment. And I see one of the questions in the chat is about this. I've really come around to, you know, think UBI is a really good thing. It, my arguments were more political than anything else. I just thought it would be very hard to sell this to the American public because of the work ethic here and you know, part of the history of opposition to social welfare programs in large part because of racism and so forth. But it seems like it's gaining traction. What is, I mean, from my own point of view, as a way to reduce working hours, it's fantastic because it basically allows people to work shorter hours. And in the money economy and the corporate economy, the death economy, as some people have called it, you know, do a lot more of the things that they want to do. So I think it's great. It's got to be high enough to actually make a difference for people. And remember, it's going to come with heavy taxes. Stephanie Kelton cannot wave a magic wand, and you know, that's modern monetary theory. You can't wave a magic wand and suddenly give these enormous amounts of. It's an extremely expensive program. There's a lot we can cut in government spending, you know, and I believe strongly in that. But you're going to have to tax the people who are working longer hours in very high paying jobs. And of course, you're going to have to tax the people at the very top to pay for it. But I think it's really great. I think it would be a key component of a climate transition that basically, you know, the way I've been thinking about the climate transition now, power down. So how do we power down our economy, giving people money so they don't have to work in the conventional economy is a really important way of doing that.
We have about 8 minutes left. And I'd like to give each of you 2 or 3 minutes to give a brief summary and look forward to some of the particular challenges and some of the more promising things that you see ahead. And again, just 2 or 3 minutes so we can wrap up.
Let me jump in here. In terms of guaranteed income and what we were just talking about, the new reality is that money isn't scarce. Everybody now knows that money is simply a numeraire. It's like saying that we're scarce of inches and feet and hectares. It's ridiculous. We all know now that we print the money. There's nothing wrong with printing money. That's what happens. And this is all now completely obvious because of the new debates around cryptocurrencies. And there's no time for me to go into that, but I've written a lot about the whole cryptocurrency thing. And what's happening now is that the central banks themselves are realizing that the best thing to do is for them to issue their own cryptocurrencies directly to every citizen in their country. We can just do away with the banks as middlemen. This is the way it's going. This is the only way that they can defeat Facebook and its Libra, which is an absolute abortion. It would be a terrible, terrible thing if we went the Libra route. So that being, okay, there's all of that as a new reality, the politics of money creation. But the issue in the real world that I'm most focused on right now is the crisis in the global food system. And we've done 2 reports on this. And it's been very hard to get all of the people who are the policymakers, the academics, to recognize the truth that the entire food system on this planet is teetering on the planet's 3% of fresh water. And meanwhile, of course, we are the water planet. The 97% of the water on this planet is saline. Ocean water. And the Earth, in her infinite wisdom, has produced the other half of the plant kingdom, which is salt-loving plants. And there are hundreds of very nutritional salt-loving plants that we can produce, and we're working actively in this area now. And It is part of the new shift away from meat diets based on animals, because we can no longer have diets grown, you know, with animal-based meat, because it takes 80% of the agricultural land, which we now need to feed people. We can't keep growing alfalfa to feed cows, and of course to chop down rainforests to have cattle running on them. And at the same time, this meat craze produces 15% of all the global greenhouse gases. So we know that the shift to plant-based diets and foods and beverages is now growing at double-digit growth all over the world with huge amount of investment money. Last time I looked, there was 26 trillion of assets under management from vegetarians, vegans, and animal lovers all over the world, who are investing in about 100 startup companies in plant-based foods and beverages. And you can find all of this on our website, free download. And so this is kind of a win-win-win, that we could shift our food system to these much more nutritious kinds of food. The one that's made it to the supermarket everybody knows about is quinoa. And this is the grain that grows wild on the salt flats around Lake Titicaca in Bolivia. But there are hundreds of others equally nutritious that can take the place of the commoditized grains, the monoculture grains in the global trade system. We've got to put those global commodity companies out of business and re-indigenize the production of food at the local level, not only shifting to indigenous plants, there's some of them growing wild like jackfruit that just grow on trees. And so this shift, I'm going to spend the rest of my life on this shift.
Wonderful. That would be fantastic. Julia, I'd love closing words for two or three minutes about challenges and promise.
Yeah, well, as a nearly lifelong vegetarian and mostly vegan, I couldn't agree more. So I guess the last point I would make is a point about economics, since we're here, you know, at the Schumacher Center for a New Economics. And that is that the sort of stranglehold of economic thinking that the discipline has had, I think, has really loosened as its failures have continued to mount. The real problems we have are political, not economic. You know, this is something Keynes recognized nearly 100 years ago. But I think, you know, more and more we have to understand that we have good answers for new economic arrangements. We don't have everything. We haven't figured it all out. But the basic thrust of what more and more people are recognizing is a humane economy founded on strong social connections and solidarity and solving our common problems and with a commons logic at its core for both ecosystems and also human relations. All of those things, we have a political problem to get there. We don't have an economic problem. And I suppose the other way of saying that is we can all be economists and follow our common sense, and that will take us to a pretty good place. One in which we have to have the courage of, you know, arguing for these things and against the really, you know, much of the very pernicious kind of thinking that has dominated economic discourse and also the ideology of capitalism now for, you know, at least 100 years, if not more.
That's a wonderful way to leave it. I appreciate both of you sharing your wisdom and your time with us. And I want to thank all the people out there in Zoom land who tuned in to watch this. Thank you both, and stay tuned for upcoming conversations.
Thanks so much, everyone. It's been really a great pleasure.
Thank Thank you for listening to the Schumacher Conversations. To hear more from visionary thinkers in the new economy movement and to discover 40 years worth of Schumacher lectures, visit our website at centerforneweconomics.org. You can strengthen our mission to bring about a just and sustainable global economy by making a donation at centerforneweconomics.org/donate or by purchasing pamphlets of your favorite lectures at centerforneweconomics.org/order-pamphlets.